as someone who has to fix them occasionally, let me assure you, they were built in a way where you, when you pull them apart, you're in wonderment at how...
I give you the Kenwood LO7D turntable.
Okay.
Just exquisitely
You'd like
made.
To give me one, you say?
Oh, I wish I had one to give you, my good friend.
March Audio is the Not an Audiophile show partner. Alan March is an engineer with a heart of music. And you can meet Alan and the team from March Audio at the Bristol Hi-Fi Show 2026. Open your eyes and ears to world-class purified technology from the celebrated March Audio power amplifier range and check out the new preamp. Visit marchaudio.com or bristolshow.co.uk. We are back, Not an Audiophile, episode 47, season 3. Today, David Carrazza and myself, Andrew Hutchison, discuss Japan. What happened? What happened to those decades, the 70s, 80s and 90s, of amazing research, development, beautiful products, stunning sound quality and build quality? What happened? And was it, in fact, you know, high-end before the filthy word high-end was even invented? Let's talk about it. Are you familiar with Edgar Kramer? Well, you should be. He's Australia's most renowned hi-fi reviewer. And his website, soundstageaustralia.com, is, well, quite amazing. Incredibly detailed, well-written reviews on all sorts of interesting hi-fi components, interviews with industry luminaries, factory tours, and, of course, news. Don't forget, Soundstage Australia is part of Soundstage Global Network. So when you're finished with this podcast, go to soundstageaustralia.com and check it out. Hey, David, thank you for coming in.
No problem at all, Andrew. Pleasure as usual.
Yeah, it's great to see you again. I hope you had a great new year. And when I say great, I mean a happy great one.
Well, it was very quiet and no dramas. That's the way I like my New Year's.
Well, yeah, minimum amount of dramas. The washing machine door won't open or close on the 24th of December. Which is what happened to us. But I fixed it.
Yippee.
And then I had to use a screwdriver to get it open and close. But we've got a new one now. And in fact, that story, having a new washing machine and what it cost, $579, is partly what I want to talk about today. Not obviously in relation to white goods, but weren't washing machines $1,000 like 40 years ago?
This is spooky. And gentle listener, we have not conferred about this beforehand. But I bought a new washing machine. It was delivered 2 days before Christmas, and it was a $1,000 washing machine. So,
oh, you got the fancy one.
I sure did, bucko. So this is really weird that we're talking about this because it actually happened to me too. But go ahead.
Was your handle stuck?
No. My washing machine's it's very nice, and it's. Works well, and it chimes at me. And
No. Your old one, though.
The old one. It was a front-loading LG.
Yeah.
And the thing lasted 18 years, so you can't complain.
He's done it right.
Yeah,
ours also was similar age and front-loader. And, Sharon went to get a load of stinky clothes. Well, they would have been non-stinky by the time, of course, the washing machine had finished. The point is that the door simply would not open and it had been giving trouble. So I had to smash it with a hammer and then lever it open with a screwdriver, at which point you then had to use the screwdriver on a continuing basis. And because we didn't want to deal with the world on the 24th buying a new washing machine, we had to use the screwdriver for some weeks. The new one is now installed and it's very nice. But the $579 or even $1,000... is part of what we're going to talk about today, but in relation to audio and
good.
What I wonder about is whether the high end always existed or never existed. We'll come back to that in a second. I would like to say, dear listener, that we would love you to follow the show and subscribe to us on YouTube, both things. And the reason why I would say that is because the show is growing, listenership is increasing, downloads are dramatically higher. Our amount of followers is up as well, but there's clearly a lot of people enjoying the show, we hope. I mean, if you're listening, you're probably enjoying it. I mean, that's the idea, isn't it? So, you know, it'd be great if you could follow the show. It helps us to get better guests so we don't have to listen to David anymore. And one of these days we could... Oh, sorry, you're here,
right,
aren't
I'm
you? Sorry,
here. I'm,
I've forgotten you were here. And the and then even one day we could afford a proper, you know, main host as well, and get, I could just go and sit on a tropical island drinking expensive cocktails. Now, so again, more seriously, please, everybody, subscribe to us on YouTube. Our YouTube channel actually will take a spike later in the year because we've got various show reports that were videos, etc. So if you subscribe, then when those videos come out, you will know. Mm. Like, for instance, at Vienna, we put our first video up, you'll be told, and you can go and watch and see what the hell's happening in Vienna, because lots of people are saying it's going to be great and many others are saying it's going to be shite. So that will be interesting. What have you got, David? No, it's me, isn't it?
It's your opening this time.
Okay, well, today is a... Oh, well, okay, here's the thing. I'm just going to open my notes because there's a lot to this. But it is about what I just said. Now, back in the day... And I suppose, you know, well, there's two aspects to this story. One is that some people lament the loss of all those Japanese brands. Some of those, where did they go? Why did they go out of business? The Japanese brands in question that are not still running today are things like Nakamichi, obviously comes to mind, Kenwood, Sharp, Aiwa, Hitachi, Sansui,
Akai,
Toshiba, Akai.
Heaps of others.
Can you see my list from there?
Optonica.
Yes, Optonica, Orex was Toshiba's premium brand, Nikko,
yep,
Sanyo, kind of, but, you know.
Sensui?
Yeah, mention that.
Sorry.
So, the big ones are probably, you know, there's a lot of love for Naka and Sansui and probably Akai. And those three, it is weird that they don't exist at all. But then there's others, like really hanging by a thread, in my opinion, such as, you know, probably Pioneer and Onkyo, although Onkyo have come back, but there's just...
Yeah, no, Onkyo are actually a surprising brand. They've actually come back with a bit of a vengeance.
And yeah.
They've released some
quite
really
good-looking
interesting
products.
Stuff
yeah,
at
yeah,
the moment.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, of course, it's not really Onkyo, but then nothing really
nothing
is.
Nothing really is.
No. But then on the other hand,
yeah,
there are brands, Yamaha, still...
Mm. Oh, yeah.
Like, bizarrely... you know, very much the way they were in the 80s. They are a serious company. They've not been taken over by a medical manufacturer or something. So Yamaha around. Rotel, Luxman, Accuphase, Esoteric, TIAC, Denon, Marantz. All. So the point of that is that the lamenting of perhaps Naka, Sansui and Akai is balanced by the fact that a lot of the brands actually are still going.
True.
Then there's two parts to the story. Well, why did they fail or why are they still going? But the other one is that I want to talk about because in sort of researching this idea, I realised probably the overriding theme is the price of the gear, because people love this old gear, the 70s, 80s and to some degree the 90s gear from Japan, and we are speaking specifically Japan. I mean, for instance, David Price... you know, who we interviewed some time ago in episode 36, when I asked him, as a POM, thinking he would love Lin and Name and, oh, I don't know, Exposure or you know, or, I don't know, think, you know, Harbour, PMC, whatever,
yeah,
I don't
exactly know.
It's all Japanese stuff, Yamaha speakers, you know, Kenwood turntables, what have you. And so I'm like, oh, okay. But the thing is, they were masterpieces of engineering.
Well, they were.
As someone who has to fix them occasionally, let me assure you, they were built in a way where you, when you pull them apart, you're in wonderment at how...
I give you the Kenwood LO7D turntable.
Okay.
Just exquisitely
You'd like
made.
To give me one, you say?
Oh, I wish I had one to
wish
give
you,
my good
one.
Friend. Yeah, they're exchanging hands for silly money now, but rightfully so, because, you know, people forget that to prepare, like to actually machine... A turntable of extraordinarily high quality costs a bomb. It just costs so much in tooling and manufacturing.
That's the impressive thing when you see them undressed. You're like, how many of these did they make? Because the investment in each part.
Correct.
These tiny little parts that are not something you buy off the shelf. And how many of those, sorry, microphone, how many of those Kenwoods, the model you refer to, how many do you... you think they may?
Oh, I don't know, a couple of thousand max. But, you know, just getting back to Nakamichi and what sank them, it was probably the TX-1000 turntable that they made. Are you aware of the TX-1000?
Yeah,
the one that had auto-centering for eccentricity with platter.
God, yeah.
Can you imagine the Rube Goldberg machine that was lurking underneath that platter to get that stuff to work? It would have been frightening.
Yeah, I'd forgotten about that, but I remember now that that was like a front cover on Australian Hi-Fi magazine.
It was beautiful too.
Yeah, yeah. It's and every Hi-Fi magazine in the world, of course. Yeah, look, Nakamichi, probably the key brand that I wish to use to present the information as follows. We all know the brand. We all loved their tape deck. So obviously when tape no longer was required, I guess to some degree when burnt CDs and mini disc and ultimately people, you know, ripping their music onto their own hard drives and then streaming services, all sorts of reasons why you no longer need a cassette deck for the purpose that really most people put it to, which was probably saving their records from excessive use and play music in the car, right? Or, you know, in a Walkman or something. So when that market disappeared, and I guess that disappeared, well, for me, I stopped using tape in the early 80s, but certainly by the early 90s, we were still selling tape decks, but it was kind of gone, right?
Yeah.
What were they to do? Because they made, once again, all of that investment in parts and stuff, they were like that, and they couldn't sell it anymore. They couldn't cash in on it. Now, here's the thing that many listeners will have forgotten, or if they're younger, will be shocked by. I have some pricing here of some Nakamichi products.
This will be entertaining.
I want to put that price into context of the year. So in the 80s, in this country, sorry for people listening in Europe and America, but you'll know your numbers and they will be in proportion on the basis that the Australian dollar is usually worth somewhere between slightly more and about half of the American dollar and usually about half of a pound. And for that matter, by extrapolation, about the same with the euro. So Australians were getting paid, people who did a normal job, the average wage, whatever, according to our Bureau of Statistics, about $279, probably before tax.
A week. Yep.
In the 80s. And it hardly went up because I think by the end of the 80s, I was making about $325 a week less tax, running a shop for crying out loud, you know, for someone else at that point. And I think that data is accurate. The other piece of data that I believe is accurate is that a Nakamichi Dragon it's hard to research these prices, but I'm going to say $2,500. Now, that's a US price that I found, but I don't think it was much more than that here. I think it was, what do you remember? What do you reckon a Dragon was?
Dragon's going for around 3K Aussie.
Three, yeah, okay. So 3,000. Now, that was early 80s, right?
Correct.
So most people in the early 80s were making $250 to $300 a week. Do you remember what you were making?
No, I can't remember, yeah. I honestly don't.
No. That's all right. It's not part of the story. No, you can pass.
It's a long time
Well,
ago.
ABS says 250, 300,
yeah,
early 80s.
Yeah, let's say 300.
So the tape
15
deck,
grand a year, right?
Yeah, so the tape deck was 10 times. It was 10 times your weekly wage.
Yeah.
All right, now people are going to say, oh, yeah, but a Dragon, that was hugely expensive. You know, it was a fancy piece and very few people bought them. Yeah, that's right. But it's true, and that's why, because it was damned expensive. But how much was a standard Nakamichi tape deck? Just a good one, like a 580 or a 680 or something. My research indicates, and my memory indicates, about a grand.
Yeah, that's about right too.
So about 3 to 4 times the average wage.
Mm-hmm.
So here's my thought, and I don't, you know, I'm not arguing for a particular answer, but a lot of people on the internet, keyboard warrior away, saying, "Oh, the high end is bullshit. it's you don't need it, it's this, it's that, and you know, and I'm like, well, what's the high end really?
Define your terms.
Well, where do you think the high end starts? Like today, in today's money, say what's a high end amplifier really? It's a loose term, and I don't even know what it means.
But it's how long is a piece of string? Honestly, I hate these questions simply because they mean different things to different people. Like honestly, for some people, spending $8,000 to $10,000 on an integrated amp is a high end amp.
Yeah, I would call that more an upper level sort of, you know, an entry level amp.
You're proving my point. That's,
my point. Yeah, that's right. I don't think it's probably high. $15,000 for an amp.
For me, it's not, because obviously I've used and I sell amps that are many, many times more expensive.
Yes.
Like we have a look at something like Griffin or Dan D'Agostino. Like, I mean, really, we're talking.
Well, that's definitely high end.
Well, of course it is. But, you know, again, the term is relative. So yes. If you're buying a Griffin or a Dan D'Agostino or an Acuphase, something like that, that's definitely high end. I think uncontestably that's high end for all people within the industry. They look at the brands and brands akin to them at that price. Well, yeah, we're talking like $15,000 to $20,000 and north. That's high end.
So $15,000 to $20,000 is high end.
For an amp.
Yes, for an amp.
Yeah.
Here's my point.
Go ahead.
According to the ABS, the current median male full-time employed wage in Australia is $2,106 a week. Not sure you or I are getting paid that, but anyhow, it is just an average, right?
Yep.
It's still the average. Yep. I know tons of people who are getting paid way more than that.
Ditto.
Like, I don't even know what their job is, but they get paid $3,000 a week to do it. So, like, and as in they can't, I know what the description of their job is, but I don't know what it means.
I know where you're going with this. Yeah. Go ahead.
So, the ratio then of your high-end Accuphase is less than 10 times. So, then we can state, unsurprisingly to some listeners, that a Dragon tape deck back in the day was a high-end piece. No one called it high-end, though, then, did they?
Good question. No, I mean, the term that was bandied around at the time, it was called state-of-the-art.
Oh, it was a bit, wasn't it? Yes, yeah, state-of-the-art. Okay, so...
And for good reason. I mean, it was the first and only deck that I know of that actually dynamically changed the azimuth of the playback head during playback, so it would correlate high-frequency phase. It was just absurdly, astonishingly inspired technology.
Yeah, it definitely was.
We'll never see again.
No. And that's, here's another thing. So I'm not, like I say, I'm not trying to make a point, people. I accept that we didn't call it high end, we called it state of the art. I'd forgotten about that lovely expression. I'm going to say forgot. Well, we don't say it much now, do we? Really? No. So it was 10, a Dragon was 10 times of our wage back then when it was available.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
A $20,000 amp now is 10 times our wage.
Yep.
But people will deride it and say it's no different. And the same people that are deriding it, if I have a point, are the people who are loving vintage gear and hankering after an Akamichi Dragon.
The irony's not lost. or the big fuck-off Pioneer receivers and stuff like that, you know.
Absolutely. Yeah. And so, but on the Pioneer receiver thing, to compare a little bit more like with like, I'm not sure how much money they were. I think they were really quite good value for money. I'm thinking they're only $1,000 or so for a pretty fancy receiver.
I cannot recall.
But, you know, your mileage will vary. It's a long conversation that will ultimately go nowhere, but I just want to say a couple of other observations. Having thought about this a lot and realising that the brands that have disappeared, perhaps other than Naka, Sansui and Akai, Sanyo, they were always more into making ICs and parts and things, and were less of a hi-fi brand. Let me just switch my notes back on here again. And JVC and Kenwood, though, made some beautiful gear.
They sure did.
So we do kind of lament those. Nikko was a bit of a non-brand, but it existed. Iwa made some nice stuff. Was working on an Iwa open reel the other day that was clearly made in the 60s. That I didn't know they did. Not many of those around. Hitachi made amazing equipment, and of course still exists, but they don't much make hi-fi. And Toshiba, also more of a IC manufacturer, semiconductors, but made some good gear.
What about the elephant in the room? Sony.
Yeah, getting to that. Getting to that. So here's my sum up, and Sony is part of that. The thoughts are really everything changes, things are changing all the time. To some degree, it's just nostalgia. There's nostalgia for old cars. They're terrible things to drive, but they look amazing in many cases, and they're inspiring for their aesthetics and design ideas and what have you. You know, some of the Citroëns, of course, the things like Lamborghini Countach is just, you know, can't even be made anymore. I mean, people couldn't even drive it back then. You know, like it was, I mean, a large German gentleman with the money to buy it, or perhaps someone who lives in the UAE, is not fitting into a Countach, probably. We're going down a rabbit hole. We'll just stop. The point is, stuff changes. It's nostalgia, and it's a nostalgia that I enjoy, but it's kind of irrelevant. But I did want to put that shine that light on that this stuff was not inexpensive. It was really impressive for two reasons, I think. One is great engineering literally provided better fidelity, because if it's an analog source, turntable and tape, it had to be mechanically beautiful and well-made and quiet and consistent and accurate to actually get good sound out of records or tape. The same applies, of course, to this day, to the likes of, say, the Diamond turntable, which is clearly, from a mechanical engineering point of view,
that's a work of art.
A two out of four, yes. The other thought was, so nostalgia, yeah, it's great fun, but that's all it is ultimately. And I've just got one other... I was just generally just saying, just market preference has clearly gone away from wanting to own a quality piece and more towards owning something that perhaps has greater features, benefits, and people is more affordable.
Well, they want affordable utilitarian stuff.
Not as committed to... Like, we used to buy... We would have one car, we'd have one camera, and we'd have one bit of hi-fi equipment. If we were rich, it would take us 10 years to pay for it all. And we would not turn it over that much, not like the turnover, I think, in hi-fi now. But then you can do it now because there's so much to buy and it's kind of all more affordable until you get to the high end, the much-derided high end. Sony.
Oh, boy. How the mighty had fallen.
Now, Sony ES, which I used to call extra special, but apparently it's more...
Elevated standard.
Extra special.
Whatever floats your boat.
There was another slightly nasty word for it as well. I can't think what it was. Nothing as nasty as, you know, Bose and buy other sound equipment. It wasn't as unpleasant as that. Or, you know, junk but loud. Some beautiful pieces they made. I was working on a mini disc player the other day, the top of the range Sony ES mini disc player. What? And I fixed it, thank God, because it was a complicated fault. But what a machine! I mean, just the way it moved, just silent and solid and everything, just very tactile. Blue fluorescent display. I don't know. Just so, did you have much to do with ES Sony over the years?
I had the great fortune I told you the SACD story. I was at the launch at the Audio Engineering Show in Los Angeles back in.
I think you left that out of the previous conversation. Tell us all about it.
Okay. Well, it was really interesting.
So SACD launch.
Yeah. Basically, I was in LA for an Audio Engineering Society show, and this is when I was intimately involved with Avid Pro Tools and DigiDesign, all that stuff, all the audio recording stuff. And I noticed a few of the journalists from the UK magazines and US magazines, like, people from Gramophone, Mott's Hi-Fi, Absolute Sound, etc. Martin Collins was there, and I thought, oh, what are they lining up for? Mm-hmm. And I just kind of snuck in.
Yeah, okay.
As you do. And these exquisite-looking gentlemen in Armani suits ushered us in and bowed. I'm thinking, oh, this is all flash. What's this? And we sat down, and they shut the door. I'm thinking, I've snuck into something. I don't know what it is. But as we sat down, it was dimly lit, and I spied, like, there was beautiful audio system in front of me. It was Nelson Pass. I've forgotten what monoblocks they were, but they were Nelson Pass monoblocks and a pair of Wilson Watt puppies.
Yeah.
And I'm thinking, oh, something's going on here. And then I saw the big Sony banner. I'm thinking, oh, Sony, they must be saying something about DSD or something. That was SACD launch. And to the very left, there was an elevated stage, quite long, and there were three gentlemen positioned about 2 metres apart.
Mm-hmm.
And again, very inscrutable look upon them, beautifully attired. And then the gentleman came out, English is second language, but beautiful Japanese English, if you know what I'm talking about, yes, listeners. Yeah, yeah. He came out, you know, extraordinarily polite, welcomed us to the launch of SACD, and basically he explained that what you're going to hear is an excerpt from Porgy and Bess, recorded at Ocean Way Studio in Los Angeles, firstly on 30 ips a second open reel, then on CD, and then on a prototype SACD player.
So they had the multi-track, or that was...
It was a two-track.
Two-track.
So they had an old Studer two-track. I can't recall the number of it. But it was a beautiful old machine. Anyway, and they had this machined copper switch thing that they must have spent thousands of dollars machining just for this event, you know, kind of zero loss, zero coloration, bloody blood.
Sony. Oh, to flick between them.
Flicker. God, someone's going to kill me here. Anyway, but it was astonishing because they did this so, the precision and the care and the love that went into this is the very antithesis of what Sony are doing now in hi-fi, but I'll get back to that in a minute. And the lights dimmed even further, and then he goes, up on the reel, and the open reel started playing. And I could just hear a tiny little bit of hiss because there was no Dolby.
No, it was running 30 inches a second.
There wasn't much modulation noise on the heads or anything, and I was thinking, oh, here we go, open reel. And, of course, this hologram appeared, and the hairs on my arms and the back of my neck just went up. And, you know, when you feel really bloody humble, you think, oh, shit, David, I've forgotten how good open reel sounds.
Oh, yeah.
So the three formats, open reel, CD, and SACD, they had a SMPTE time clock with them, so they're all locked at the same position in the song. And after about 10, 15 seconds of that, and then he leaned forward and bowed and goes, CD. And I swear to God, the whole image just collapsed into a two-dimensional pancake.
Yeah.
It was a little bit harsh. It wasn't horrible, but by that time they got all the high-frequency shit out of CD. They started to know how to master the CD.
Well, this was... can we pin a year on this?
Yeah, it was in the 99 or 2000.
Yeah, okay.
I'm pretty sure. Yep. Just on the
CD at that point.
Yeah, it was pretty good. Book. It was okay. You know,
for those who will chuckle when I say I thought it sounded pretty good, but...
No, there were some great CDs out. I'm sick of this binary shit that, oh, CD sounds crap, vinyl sounds good. Any format engineered well sounds good.
Yes.
Okay.
Yeah, well, that's engineered for the format to some degree or mastered for the format. But, I mean, they're good-sounding CDs. So the CD sounded all right, but the imaging...
Yeah, the spatial qualities had just gone away. It was like, listener, it was not subtle. It was like someone had slapped you across the face with a wet fish and went, hey, take that.
Yeah.
I'm going, fucking hell. The dynamics are there, the frequency response is there, but all the spatial information simply went away.
It's the bit that I've always said CD doesn't do. It's like when you put a record on, you go, oh, it's just this holographic sense of space I wonder, we have never really talked about it much on the show. We must get a digital guru on one day and explain why it doesn't work.
Well, without derailing...
let's move forward, though.
Without derailing the story, I think that's got a lot to do with phase aberration with vinyl, but that's another thing. And moving on...
So it's actually a fault of vinyl?
Yeah, a euphonic fault.
Yes. It's very pleasant. then what happened then when
they went to SACD and Hosanna in the highest, what happened was the image just went into this big holographic bloom again.
Yeah.
But no tape hiss, no modulation noise, of course.
Yes.
So it was the best of both worlds. Here, it, finally, we've got a medium that gives us all the nuance and the loveliness of you know, what tape always has done with spatial cues, and the quiet accuracy of digital. And I was like someone had baptized me or something, and I'd sprung up from the river gone, hallelujah. And I almost floated out of that fucking room. I couldn't stop talking to people about SACD for the next week or two.
Yeah, wow.
So getting back to Sony, as soon as I got back to Australia, I bought an SACD 1, their big flagship thing. Now, you want to talk about something that was well built.
Yeah.
Jesus, Mary and Joseph, this thing. They sold for $10,000 in this country. They were losing money on it. They were losing money on it.
Which is part of the conversation I wanted to have about it, actually.
Yep.
Hey Now Hi-Fi. Go and speak to Jeff, Jeff Haynes at Hey Now Hi-Fi today. Or if you don't want to speak to him, and you should, but if you don't, check out the website, heynowhifi.com.au. But speak to Jeff. He has an amazing range of products, many exclusive to his own store, but certainly all are very carefully selected to offer incredible performance at entirely sensible prices. heynowhifi.com.au. Look, I've dabbled with all of that stuff. By the time I sold Sony briefly for a few years, which was the late 90s, early 2000s, I don't know if a lot... I will say I wasn't an ES dealer, but then I was briefly. We elevated ourselves. And then... But I don't know that we... For some reason, I don't know what the availability... It must have been very limited availability. Maybe it was only one dealer per state or something like that. There was a reason why we didn't have much of that stuff, other than the fact that it was incredibly expensive.
Yeah, for sure.
So, I mean, $10,000 then for the SACD player would... well, hang on.
That was real money.
I can tell you what it was worth because I have the magical...
Yeah.
I have the magical chart here, which so I can back consult.
So 2000,
typical wage was $800 to $900.
Yeah.
So it was, once again, the magical tenfold the weekly wage.
Yeah.
So, you know, it's... I mean, once again, it was a piece of high-end. But then we were probably almost using the term high-end by then, I guess, you know. Yeah.
Well, you know, back in the day, the Absolute Sound, you know, its moniker was the high-end journal or something of that ilk.
Yeah, I was going to say, Stereophile and Absolute Sound probably invented the expression.
Yeah,
I used to equate high-end with American expensive equipment, you know, the Krells and the... And the Levinsons and the Wilson Audios, I guess, as you mentioned, you know, of the world, and almost as a separate category of, I will never own that, I guess, because wasn't excited enough about owning nice pieces of hi-fi, but there's only so much money you've got, and I'd prefer to spend it on motorbikes, cars, and aeroplanes.
Well, this is it, and for a lot of people, what they designate as high-end, as you've so accurately pointed out, is you know, a highly aspirational, desirable gear that most mortals will never be able to afford. And I'm not saying that in a derogatory style; it's just the nature of the beast.
The overriding, we'll get back to Sony, the point as per the in the previous segment, we're talking about this, I put forward a lot of information, but I was kind of trying to draw that slightly hypocritical connection between those who love the gear from the 80s, 90s, 70s, but don't love high-end now, that's slightly... You know, it's a bit... But I don't care. But stop slagging off expensive new equipment and only liking the old stuff, I think is what I'm saying. There is a lot of bullshit in high end though.
Of course there is.
So much really good gear. I think I mentioned Doma Turntable before. Things like I'm a bit of an Accuphase lover. You say Accuphase, I say Accuphase. Who's right? Who's wrong?
Let's ring up Japan. I'm sure they'll
call the whole thing off. They would know best, I guess. And I feel that there is a quality and a value there that, as there is with a number of other brands, you know, Esoteric Audio and I think with Luxman as well. I don't know. Airtight, we spoke to Airtight, Jack from Airtight, the owner, in episode 42. I got a real, and for those who haven't listened to that episode, you really should, because he is the nicest, most down-to-earth guy, drives an inexpensive Honda to work, but builds expensive tube amplifiers using ladies of a certain age to assemble them. And that's a terrible expression to use for his
One's mind does wander.
Yes, but that's probably the wrong term. But the point is that, yeah, quality is absolutely still in his heart. It is what he wants to do, yep. And that's part of the Japanese way of the day. Which, if we swing back to Sony, like you said, what happened? Because clearly those products were, well, I don't think they ever made any money out of them.
No.
Because the thought, the design, the execution, and people, it was a $10,000 SACD player. Yeah, but that's not what Sony sold it into Sony Australia or Sony US or Sony Europe for. You know, there's still quite a lot of money in any product at some point that goes towards distribution, warehousing, warranty, you know, paying for the retail staff and the premises, etc. These are costs of getting equipment into people's homes, not just the making of the gear. I don't see how they ever made money out of them, so yeah, I guess that's why they're not doing anymore. There's a great term for the Japanese way of doing things, and I'm going to pronounce it really bad.
You pronounce away.
Monozukuru. Monozukuri. So Monozukuri.
Yep.
Monozukuri. Japanese is not my thing. They, you know, and that is about turning raw materials into a finished product, presenting it to people as a working piece of something, but doing it with a quality through all aspects of the process, the design, manufacture, the way you speak to customers, etc. I guess what am I saying is that lost in Japan to some degree, but I don't think it is.
No.
And that's why they don't do what they did anymore.
For big corporates like Sony, I'm in furious agreement with you. I just think the bean counters and the board members just said, nah, we're losing money on this and there's so many other players and you know what, PlayStation's way more profitable for us.
Yeah, the funny, when I was reading a little bit about the brand, it was funny how they kind of, Sony, of course, everyone knows the PlayStation and also the film company, the music arm of Sony, etc. It seems that they all sort of operated independently, and one kind of destroyed the other, because if we think about the time when DVD was being released in the late 90s as well, it was delayed for many years, thanks very much to Sony, who single-handedly, maybe with some assistance from others, but were very pro the regionalization system, which delayed the launch. Perhaps not so much into the US, but into the rest of the world, Europe and Australia, dramatically, because that had to be formed. You know, we have to create this regionalization system so that we can slip our release dates of films, which is something that doesn't happen anymore, I don't think, does it? But back then, you know, some films would not arrive into some markets for 6 or 12 months after the US Hollywood release. Once again, more nostalgia, of which I have little for actually the 80s and 90s mostly. I like the fact that a movie comes out today and it's everywhere tomorrow or even today. Any thoughts on this whole sort of messy nostalgic subject, David? I mean, you obviously have a real nostalgia for that ES Sony gear.
I've spoken about in past episodes, some of the, you know, I mean, I joke to friends that I could have been a slumlord by now had I had saved my money and not spent on the high end. Because seriously, I would have owned a lot of property. But I don't regret that at all, because I owned and used, and this is very, very different from reading about.
Yes.
I owned and used the most exotic gear in the 80s and 90s.
Yes, you did.
You know, the very top of the high-end tree, like Apogee Acoustics. I had Triamp Systems. I had Single-Ender Triads. I had Goldman. I had Griffin. I had blah-de-blah. And it was fun. Am I nostalgic for it? That's a very good question. I respect, admire, and sometimes miss the gear. And if that's nostalgia, well, yes, I am nostalgic. Do I lay it awake at night and wish I had it again? No, I don't.
No, I'm like that with my old cars. They were amazing in their day, but I don't want one now.
Yeah.
I just want good air conditioning and a quiet ride and a decent stereo. You mentioned that property market versus what have you, versus the price of hi-fi, but sometimes some of our younger listeners wonder, I guess, why their parents didn't buy every house in the street. They were so cheap. Why didn't you just buy next door when it went on the market, etc.? And there was a couple of reasons for that, and we've alluded to the lesser income, obviously. But the other thing is that the cost of filling up a house full of furniture, hi-fi, window dressings, what have you, carpets. Everything costs pretty much the same as it does now. numerically, right? So
that's true.
So everything's kind of a tenth of the price now to fill up your house.
Well, I give you white goods. They're stupidly cheap
in
comparison.
To go full circle, we're talking about our washing machine story. I'm sure exactly. I bought a washing machine for $579 23 years ago.
But there's the other greater political and somewhat nefarious sociological thing, economic thing that we're talking about with housing in the West, especially in Australia. We, you know, 40, 50 years ago, a house was basically a home. It's a place where you lived.
Mm.
And by the turn of the century, it had became a speculative financial instrument. And that's what's ruined a lot of Western nations is the unaffordability of housing. But that's a different topic.
It is a different topic. It's not related to hi-fi, except the bit where it's... Yeah, they're worth, if you work it out and you take wages into account, it's not as bad as you think, but it's pretty bad. They're worth about twice as much as they should be, which is horrific, of course, which means you need to work,
Can I just jump in?
Yeah,
Just for a moment, and this touches on a really interesting point now that you're kind of, if we're tying together all these economic factors about average weekly wage, and let's talk about homeowners who, if they wish to, could... pull some equity out of their houses. Mm. I mean, high end has never been more affordable.
Oh, no. I'm
sorry.
Where I was heading. Sorry.
I'm sorry. Like, I don't care what people say in the forums over at ASR or whatever Reddit rabbit hole you want to go down. Mm. If you look back, say, 30, 40 years and you went like for like, now for the same kind of money, you can just buy outrageously good gear. Mm. Like I can put together a $20,000 audio system that would annihilate anything, anywhere near that price years and years ago.
Yes.
And I mean that.
Well, what I just said is that houses are effectively in this country at least about twice, depending where you live, I guess, but the twice what they should be worth if we compare them with wages, etc., which means you've got twice the equity in your house as you kind of deserve or have earned, except, you're not really performing an act by owning a house. Like you say, it's somewhere to live. Everyone's got to live somewhere. So it's free money. Spend it on Wi-Fi. Spend it on Wi-Fi so that you can have Hi-Fi.
Boom, boom.
Spend it on Wi-Fi. The hell did that come from? I've got one other little, I was just going to say that a little bit of, this is just nostalgia now. It's not nostalgia, it's horrid trivia. But back in the day, if you wanted to like open an account with a hi-fi company or something to buy stuff for your stock for your store or whatever, or even if you just wanted to get a credit card or something, you'd fill in a form, like, a loan application form or whatever, and you'd have to fill in your household goods would be part of your assets.
Yeah, absolutely.
And I remember having $50,000 or $60,000 worth way back in the late 80s or the 90s of household goods. I'm not sure I paid that much for them, but that's what I wrote on the form. The point is a lounge suite, your white goods, your washing machine, your fridge. If you'd done a kitchen renovation or a bathroom renovation, and then you added your hi-fi and you added a few other things and a bit of jewellery, everyone had 50 or 60 grand's worth of stuff in the house. The house only cost 100. Anyhow, moving right along. Thank you for listening to us bore you with that, folks, but there's lots of thoughts that come out of that. But really, one is hi-fi's never been cheaper. And that's without mentioning the truly affordable stuff, which we have reviewed before, things like Weem, which are just literally free. Now, other thoughts. We'll have a quick break and we will be right back with an AI story related to episode 45, Danny Ritchie.
StereoNet, find your tribe. Hi-fi and home cinema forums, classified ads, reviews, and of course, news. StereoNet's got a little bit of everything. StereoNet.com, a proud sponsor of Not an Audiophile.
We're back with David in the studio and myself, and we're having a bit of a general ramble today, but I think an interesting one. But this next thing, so I interviewed Danny Ritchie recently, who's a character. He has his lovers.
It was a great episode, actually.
Well, thank you. Oh yeah, you did send me a message. Yeah.
It was great.
He's a great speaker. He knows his stuff. And people will say, knows his stuff. He's not an engineer. He's a snake oil salesman or something. I'm like, well, he's a guy running a business who believes in certain things. And for those that also agree with him, with those ideas, they buy his stuff. I mean, it's no different to an expensive push bike shop. I personally don't need a $10,000 push bike. A $1,000 one will do nicely. I don't sit around hammering out on the internet about these pricks buying $10,000 push bikes. I say, go your hardest. Keep Taiwan in business. Now, but Dan, he's quite a likable guy, but he has his flaws, I guess. We all do, right? But I don't know about this one. Now, do you remember during the quite long episode, people should listen to it, I'm pretty sure it was 45, episode 40, it's only a couple of episodes ago. Was it 45? Yeah, it was, episode 45. Thanks to Brad Sirhan, by the way, for organising Danny for that episode. Job well done, because I think it was an entertaining episode for a variety of reasons. But here's the thing, that when I listened back to it, when I was editing it, I'm like, and my reaction at the time when interviewing him was quite, what the fuck did you just say? So what he was talking about, AI... They were recording microphone captured sound in the room of stereo systems playing in different configurations and feeding, I don't know, the audio file, excerpts of, because he did say, well, we were making long files, they were too large, it couldn't cope with it, we made shorter recordings, we were feeding it into AI. I'm not sure that he elaborated to what type of AI, and in the end it could tell us whether the power conditioner and special power cables were in circuit or not.
I do recall that.
And yes. I went, you what? Like that's a major breakthrough, right? Because most, no, not most people, but many listeners, I'm going to say about half, would say power conditioners and power cables, bollocks. The other half probably believers. But the ones who say bollocks, well, you know, you've saved yourself some money, so you could spend it elsewhere in the system. So, you know, it's not, you know, whatever. I mean, you know, I'm personally not a great believer in power cables. I have heard demonstrations where I was fairly convinced that they had performed an improvement.
What about, how do you stand with, say, power filters and or power conditioners, Andrew?
Oh, I think they're bollocks, all right? Okay. So, and that's because I think the people at the power station do a pretty good job of generating electricity. And people would be right now going, oh, you're such a dick, because all of the interference and the noise. And I know there's all that, all right? I know, because I can, you know, for a lifetime I've worked with electricity in an industrial part of town. People are running welders. People are running power tools. There's all sorts of hash that goes back up into the power. and I know it's there, but I would also say that the circuitry inside the amplifier CD player, SA CD player, turntable, would do a very nice job of filtering that out once it's rectified, regulated, filtered, what have you, right? But I'm also not in the slightest bit concerned that people think that they work and they want to buy one. I say go for it. I do have a little bit of problem with power regenerators because we have a pretty fancy piece of equipment here at the moment for repair that's been destroyed by a power generator that went wrong, went onto the wrong frequency and the wrong voltage.
Whoops.
And fried a very expensive piece of kit that, quite frankly, I don't think would have sounded any better through that because the quality of the power supply in that device is such that I don't think it would have made any difference. But for the owner, he felt that it did, and he's created an expensive repair for himself. But that getting back to the power conditioner thing and the AI thing, now for those that either believe or disbelieve, if AI could consistently do effective, I guess you'd call it AI blind testing, and tell you whether if it can pick it every time that mm-hmm. there's a power conditioner, that the gear is plugged through a power conditioner and then it isn't,
yep.
And then no longer can the naysayers, such as myself, argue that there isn't an improvement or at least a difference. Thoughts?
Oh, look, I'm in agreement with you. I don't have much to add because I don't, I like the scientific method. I like to know exactly what procedural context was put into place, what mics they used, what power conditioners. Do you know what I'm saying?
Mm.
Let's have the guts of it all.
Yeah.
And the actual procedure that you used in order to extrapolate this result. So I'm not doubting that the result obtained was valid, but I'm very curious to know exactly the points along that chain.
Yeah, and I think that's why I've brought it up is because I feel like I'd like to ring Danny up and say, hey, can we revisit this?
Absolutely.
I'd like to think that he does like a chat, so there's a good chance that he would indulge us, perhaps. Yeah. But what I'd like... So you've already put in a vote that you'd like me to contact Danny and discover further what he discovered.
Yeah, and how he discovered
it. Yeah, and the methodology. Correct. And so I would like the audience to go to our YouTube channel now.
And vote.
And vote by way of making a comment, yes,
that'd be great, folks.
We want to know.
Yeah.
Because there's a website out there that I noticed, that I discovered from our logs on the server that... it was sending us a bit of traffic. They'd put a link to that episode, and they indeed were wondering as well. So there is a bit of thought out there because if Danny's pulled this off, he's a genius because, this ends an argument, and it is an argument.
It puts it to bed, doesn't it?
It puts it to bed. Yeah. It does. And so he backpedaled slightly when you listen to the episode, or maybe he didn't really fully grasp what he'd achieved. I wouldn't say backpedaled, but we didn't really...
He underplayed it.
He underplayed it, and I didn't want to explore it too much because I am not an expert at AI and its different versions. Do you know much about how you'd feed an audio file, David, into AI and have it examine it and... I don't know how that would work.
No, well, I just
we need Danny, do we?
Well, we need to speak to Danny, but I would presuppose they recorded an audio file, and how they recorded it is equally as important.
Mm.
So, record an audio file, whether it's 10, 30 seconds, whatever it is, with and without the power conditioner or the cables or whatever, and then just. If it's a spectral analysis or some kind of Fourier analysis that they've done with and it depends what large language model they've used and all that jazz. So, yeah, I want to get to the granular level of what happened.
Yeah, I think we'd like to look into it.
Yeah.
And like I said, audience, you much-loved listeners, please let us know. YouTube channel, go there. It's the only way you can easily communicate. You can send us an email, of course, as well.
Yeah.
Yeah, not an audio file. podcast@gmail.com. Just send us an email and say, "Yeah, we want to hear what he did."
Well, in conclusion, I don't want to rabbit on too much about this, but honestly, if he has done this in good faith and the methodology's sound, if you'll pardon the pun, this is pretty much a bloody breakthrough.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Yeah, it is. And that's... Yeah, when I listened to my own reaction at the time, clearly I thought it was, and then it sort of settled, and we didn't. But we were trying to cover a lot of material on that day, and we had a very long chat, you know, many hours, and we did edit a little bit out, but we didn't edit out any of the details to do with the AI. So, so yeah, thank you. We will, and thank you to the listeners. Once again, please let us know. All right, quick ad, and we'll be right back to wrap up. Do you remember the good old days when you'd walk into a hi-fi shop and speak to the owner and they'd enthusiastically show you a range of equipment and be excited, perhaps even more excited than you were, about what they had to offer? And the reasons why they had it there is because it was great gear. It wasn't necessarily the brands you knew, but there were brands that you were about to know. Talk to Alex at the Hi-Fi Shop. Exposure Electronics, Neat Acoustics, EAR Yoshino. Brands you don't see everywhere. But at the other hand, Alex has all of the brands that you do see everywhere, so you can make comparisons. Visit the Hi-Fi Shop today, or visit the website today, hifishop.com.au. A touch of the old, very much a touch of the new. And we are back with David Carrazza, the audio systems designer at Brisbane Hi-Fi. Which is a sister company, by the way, of Trimera,
yeah.
Which sells some beautiful equipment. So does Brisbane Hi-Fi, for that matter. What's your favourite piece at Brisbane Hi-Fi, David, that you enjoy selling?
There's one or two, if I can, you can indulge me. Anything that Name makes, I just think, I haven't listened to Name for decades, and when I came back to Brisbane and started listening to Name, I went, oh, my God, I've forgotten how good this stuff is. And obviously things like Acuphase, just astonishingly well made and good. And the problem with Acuphase, you sell it to a customer, you never see the customer again.
No, that's it. They're done.
But at the low end too, there's still decent, honest stuff. Like some of the Rotel stuff sounds very, very good. But I tell you what, the Black Horse is, or the Dark Horse, Black Sheep, whatever you want to call the quadruped, is...
Yes.
Is Roxanne, the Roxanne Atessa, like for $2,500, what an amp, man.
Is that right?
What an amp.
Yeah, I kind of forgotten about Roxanne. I mean, I used to have quite of a fondness for Roxanne, and not the one with the red light. Nice, for $2,500.
Toroidal transformer and beautiful industrial design, got a bit of gravity in it. Try and lift it up and you'll see what I mean.
Yeah, okay.
Wow. Right. Just a great amp, great sounding amp.
Yeah, all right. Cool. Digital lens, just straight analog.
Yeah, no, digital lens.
Yeah. Digital lens.
Yeah.
Bloody amazing.
It's a bit nutty for the price.
Yeah. And remote, obviously.
Yeah.
Okay, well, we'll leave you with that. On another note, speaking of amplifiers, one of our very generous sponsors, and in this case, more recently, show partner, which is the premium position for a sponsor. We only have a handful of sponsors. By the way, if you ever want to be a sponsor of the show, you should get in touch, notanaudiophilepodcast@gmail.com. Our advertising packages are incredibly affordable, if I say so myself. March Audio, Alan March, hell of a nice guy. He's been on the show, very smart cookie. I know I say that in the ad sometimes, but he kind of is. He's always an interesting a man to have a conversation with. And he's taking his range of loudspeakers and amplifiers to the Bristol show. And the reason why I mention that, other than I guess it's sort of a favour to an advertiser to mention that he's at the show, but to our UK audience, go and speak to Alan. He's a great guy. Interestingly, of course, he's just returning to where he came from. He is from Bristol, and so he's going back. So he's done that old, I left 10 years ago, I've designed all these wonderful products, and now I'm taking them back to show off. So, and that's from the 20th of Feb in a few days' time, depending when you're listening to this. Of course, if you're listening to this in 2028, it was quite a while ago. What else have we got? Final business. Thank you, everybody, for listening. As we mentioned at the start of the show, would love you to follow and subscribe on YouTube. And please make the comment about the Danny Ritchie AI issue. We'd like to know your thoughts on that. And of course, anything else you'd like us to discuss on the show or guests you would like us to find. We have an interview with someone who never speaks to the press at all, ever. Coming up soon. Bye, folks.
You don't want to divulge who this is, do you?
I can't say who it is. No, but I've done the recording.
Okay. Well,
he's fascinated. He is a he. He is an amplifier designer.
Yeah. Okay.
He is from the UK.
And he doesn't do interviews.
He never does interviews.
Wow, this
it's
is...
Not, it's not Roy Gandy, though. Just did the occasional interview.
Oh, ouch.
But Roy, you know, if you're listening, Roy, and I know you are, because, you know, he's told me he's a fan of the show. No, he hasn't. Love to have you on the show, Roy. Or if a Riga fan is listening and would like to let Roy know that we'd like him on the show, because his way of doing business is inspiring and we'd like to speak to him. Thank you, David, for coming in.
Thank you, Andrew.
We'll speak to you again soon. Bye, everybody.